All right, this lecture will be broke up into like three different sections. We can take breaks between if y'all want them. First part's gonna be on my thesis research. Second part will be on shorebird identification of some common species in Tennessee. And the last part, some general stuff involving shorebird management in the interior US. So my thesis research was entitled Influences of Drawdown, Waterbird Use in Mudflats in Two Tennessee River Reservoirs in East Tennessee. Justification for my study, there are 40 species common in North America, and of those, there's 31 that commonly migrate through the Tennessee River Valley. Many of these birds travel great distances each year, and here's a map showing the southward migration. As you can see, get the pointer going here. There we go. Anyway, as you can see, we have quite a few birds coming down the Atlantic coast, and a lot of these are coming through the interior into East Tennessee during fall migration. In the United States, however, we've lost over half of our wetlands since European settlement, and of all the shorebird species that have been evaluated, they're estimating that greater than 50% are declining. Migratory stopovers are critical for shorebird survival. They use these areas to replenish their fat reserves. A few studies in the Mississippi Valley documented that an shorebird, which is about killdeer size, 45 grams, must consume 6 grams of invertebrates per day to maintain its body mass, and an additional 2 grams a day to meet the physiological demands of migration. So a total of 8 grams per day must be consumed. And they've done quite a bit of modeling in the Mississippi Valley, determining habitat requirements based off of these kind of constants. Also, Lennon and Kremitz found that average stopover duration of pectoral sandpipers in the Mississippi Valley was between 8 and 12 days. There's quite a few different studies looking at stopover duration. Most of them are estimating anywhere running from like 4 to 18 days, with most falling in the 10-day category. And in the Tennessee River Valley, shallowly flooded mudflats that become exposed during drawdowns provide one such stopover. In the Tennessee River Valley, the Tennessee Valley Authority manipulates water levels in 9 main stem and 40 tributary reservoirs. And historically, they initiated drawdowns right after the 4th of July. However, TVA has received increased pressure from landowners and political lobbyists to delay the drawdown until after Labor Day. This could bring about changes to the availability of mudflat habitat for water birds fall. Two reservoirs in East Tennessee that I looked at, Douglas and Chickamauga reservoirs. And here's a map showing where they're at. Douglas Reservoir, my study sites were located near Rankin Bottoms, WMA. This site is drawn down in mid to late July. Its actual initiation of drawdown is August 1st. And my other site was down near Hiawassee Wildlife Refuge of Chickamauga Reservoir, and this is drawn down after Labor Day. Drawdown initiation begins in October. So my objectives were to compare the abundance of water birds on mudflats between these two reservoirs, and my treatments were an August versus an October drawdown, and those are my sampling dates there for 05 and 06. To show the degree of change that out there during a drawdown, here's a particular site at Chickamauga Reservoir on the 13th of September, then the same site again on November 8th. We sampled 4 mudflats per reservoir, and we did this by scan surveys from a permanent location at each mudflat, and we surveyed these 2 times per week per mudflat reservoir. All surveys occurred between sunrise and 5 hours as we recorded species-specific abundance. Schematic of our scan survey area. We had a permanent location, and we scanned a 180 degree semicircle and recorded all, or we scanned out to a 60 power magnification with a Swarovski spotting scope and recorded all species within that 180 degree circle or semicircle. So because we use the same scope out to a constant power, we can assume that the same viewing area was sampled at each of these mudflats. So here's some results from 2005 And this is mean daily abundance per mudflat along the y-axis and month along the x-axis. Chickamauga is indicated in the maroon and Douglas in the light blue. And as you can see, in September, we had mean daily abundance was significantly greater at Douglas over Chickamauga. And in the months of November, December, January, the opposite was true. And we found no other significant differences for the other months. And here is the same comparison in 2006. And here we had, in the month of August, Douglas was greater in Chickamauga. And again, November, December, and January, mean daily abundance per mudflat was greater at Chickamauga. And you notice the similarities between these two graphs. I mean, we observe the same trends, and these are related to habitat conditions and overall temporal availability of mudflats for these birds, which I'll get into here in a minute. And this is what I was stating, corresponding with the mudflat conditions at these sites. So here we take a look at what I'm talking about. Douglas Reservoir, in early September, full pool is at 991. Up there it says 986. This has dropped, 5 feet? So we have some large expanses of bare mudflat out there. However, at Chickamauga Reservoir at the same time period, it's completely flooded because they don't initiate drawdown until October. Then we look in late November, and we have some total changes. Up here at Douglas on the top right, this is all vegetation up here. I know it's kind of tough to tell. A lot of this is cocklebur, some other mudflat plants coming in, and it's not suitable for shorebird use. And so that's why we had the big fallout of abundance. However, down here at Chickamauga on the bottom right, we have huge expanses of bare mudflats that provide habitat for shorebirds at that time. That's why we saw those differential peaks in mean daily abundance. Looking at our species composition, this is both years combined at Douglas Reservoir. Up top there, we have total number of birds we observed each year, and also a number of species. And notice that during neither 2005 or 2006, we did not observe any shorebirds in January. And you also see the high prevalence of tan-colored boxes, that's killdeer, 62% of the total birds observed at this reservoir. And we also see in the blue and the green colored boxes, least and pectoral sandpipers each comprise 13% in those early months of August and September. And one thing to notice is that the highest richness each year was observed right after mudflats started becoming exposed. So right when that habitat's fresh, brand new, wide open, we observe this high richness. And this also corresponds with the peak migration that's going on. We have more species coming through at this time. So keep that in mind when we look over here at Douglas or at Chickamauga Reservoir, which is the late drawdown. No birds were observed in August and September because these sites were flooded. And again, we have 77% of the total was comprised of killdeer. We also had quite a few Wilson snipe comprising 15%. And one thing to notice again, the highest richness was observed right when mudflats first started becoming exposed. But you notice here, our highest monthly richness we ever had at this site was 6 compared to I think in 06 at September, or in 2006 in September at Douglas, we had like 14 species and 13 in September. So here we take a look at correlation between water levels and shorebird abundance. This is Douglas Reservoir, again, the August 1st drawdown, and we have water levels beginning to drop there at the beginning of August, and mudflats first start becoming exposed at 991. I think full pool is like 992 or 93. And then once water levels hit 970, all the water is restricted to the main channel. So in 2005, all the mudflats were completely exposed by October 5th. So no new habitat was being exposed. And this corresponds with our trends in mean daily abundance, where it really fell off towards the end of the year. We had a Pearson correlation of 0.62 and an R-squared value of 0.39, indicating 39% of the variation in shorebird abundance could be explained by gauge height. Again, again, this zone here from lake elevations at 991 to 970 is when mudflats are continuously becoming exposed, and we consider this our suitable habitat range. Here's Douglas Reservoir in 2006, and notice along the x-axis, the drawdown was initiated a little bit earlier this past year than it was in 05. We started our study about 2 weeks earlier, and again, we have that drastic peak occurring right as the mudflats are first coming exposed. And I failed to mention this on the first slide, but the orange line is total abundance, including killdeer, and the yellow line are other species, excluding killdeer. But you see that same peak, and it really follows along. And mudflats were continually becoming exposed until November 6th. This year it was like October 4th. And here we had an R-squared of 0.28, so a little bit less of the variation could be explained by gauge height in 06 at Douglas. All right, Chickamauga Reservoir in 2005, and this lake only fluctuates about 8 feet. Drawdown was initiated in October. And you see, there's where the mudflats first start becoming exposed. And we see a great peak in shorebird abundance continuing through the fall. And this is because mudflats continued to become exposed even when it dropped down here. There's no cutoff. It didn't get restricted to the main channel. And that's typical a lot of the main stem reservoirs like Kentucky Lake, Watts Bar, even Loudoun out here. The more the water drops, there's just going to be huge expanses becoming exposed. So here we have a suitable habitat range. Once lake levels hit, 80.5, and anywhere less than that is considered suitable habitat because there's new habitat becoming exposed for the birds. And here we have the same comparison in 2006. And notice that water levels stayed a little bit higher at this site in 2006 than 05. But again, we had our first appearance of mudflats on October 5th, and also that corresponded with our first appearance of shorebirds. And one thing to note at both these reservoirs, once that first little speck of habitat was exposed out there, there were birds on it instantly. I mean, I'm talking like within hours, and other people have documented that as well. And it just kind of, when you think about the big scale trend you're seeing, there's got to be just tons of birds flying around that are coming through at all times. I mean, especially during migration, but they're looking for this habitat, and they're keying in on it instantly when it becomes exposed. And here we had an R squared of 0.67, indicating 67% of the variation in abundance could be explained by gauge height. All right, so some mechanisms that were potentially influencing our results include hydroperiod and mudflat acreage and suitability differences between the two reservoirs. Again, I mentioned how hydroperiod can influence just the availability of habitat, which we saw from my other trends. Not only available habitat, but also these drawdowns influence microhabitat factors. How fast the water comes off can greatly influence the moisture and compaction. And we tested these. This is an Aquaterra soil moisture probe and a compaction meter. We had transects. I'm not presenting any of those results today, but it can drastically influence the suitability of habitat out there. So once it's habitat for a while, but you have, with an early drawdown at Douglas, we had vegetation coming in. We also had drastic drying of mudflats because it fluctuates at such a great degree. There are sometimes, you know, a foot and a half of water would come off overnight. And so that stuff dries out real quick. Other things that could be influenced by drawdown are food availability. And we're currently analyzing some of this data. We're talking about invertebrates, moist soil seeds, and vegetative browse. And the browse is mainly for Canada geese that get up on the flats and feed. And here's a couple pictures of us quantifying these things. This is a core sampler that we sampled benthic invertebrates and placed them in bags and sorted them, and walls over here is about ready to put a new vegetation mud flats, and this was typical up at Douglas Reservoir. Chickamauga Reservoir, the drawdown was initiated so late that it really didn't give it any time to establish down there. At the end of the growing season here is about early November, so that's kind of right when the mudflats were starting to become exposed, so you had little vegetation to worry about. And here's again, we're in response September 8th, the same spot on the 17th of October. This is just a little bit over a month, and you can see that cocklebur out there is almost knee high already. So, and we had some stuff that was almost over your head. So our recommendation based on these trends that we've observed is to draw down these reservoirs sequentially. This is done typically, I'm sure you all have been exposed to like moist soil management within impoundments. We're kind of talking about the same thing. If we draw down these reservoirs sequentially, provide newly exposed mudflats throughout migration in the Tennessee River Valley. And for this study, I don't really need to cover too much of this. Tennessee Valley Authority and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service funded this project. And this is John Campbell, who worked on this project with me for 2 years. And that's kind of the end of the first section of this. Anybody have any questions? You can drill me, man. Anyone?
Did you all find the vegetation to be a good thing or bad thing for shorebirds? I mean, did that increase your invertebrates, or did that decrease?
Well, we didn't really look at how it influenced invertebrates. But we did do some modeling, and there's some stuff in the literature stating that most shorebirds prefer mudflats with less than 25% horizontal cover. One of our models we found, I didn't present it today, but basically once the mean horizontal coverage throughout all of our plots out there reached 80%, we had no bird use. So that's something we can look back in. When did we hit that point? And I think it'll, you know, line up exactly with what we found, because shorebird use up at Nugget, where we have vegetation, drop drastically once that vegetation becomes established. So, anybody else? Take a break or go on to the ID stuff? Keep rolling? All right. And I'm not sure what Dr. Gray is going to require of you for this. Surely not a scientific name like we did on waterfowl, but there's 31 species that commonly migrate through Tennessee Valley, and we're looking at 17 here. This is from the undergrad course. So the first group we have are the plovers, and here I believe we have three different species that commonly migrate through, and most of these, again, were observed on my mudflats in East Tennessee, and also out in West Tennessee with Drew out there. These include like piping plover, killdeer, black-bellied plover. These are, in general, small, plump-bodied. They have these short, little, thick bills compared to a lot of the other sandpipers, which are longer for probing into the mud. These guys are more sight feeders than all the sandpipers. I mean, most of us have watched a killdeer running around or been annoyed by one, stand there for a while, spot something, run down and track it down. And so they're often heard before they're seen as well. First species we have is the black-bellied plover. This isn't extremely common, but we do see them during fall migration, not sure about the spring. Mostly coastal species, but they are found along lake shores and agricultural fields. And one other thing to mention with the plovers in general is they're more kind of their microhabitat. They're a little bit more tolerant of dry sites than sandpipers are. And here we have, again, a dark, thick bill. These have black legs. And here we have the breeding plumage on the lower left, and the center picture is in winter plumage. And also a white rump. One other thing, in flight, you'll see a white wing stripe, where you won't see it with other species that look similar. Semi-palmated plover looks almost identical to a killdeer, which we're all familiar with, except for they have just one breastband, where a killdeer has two. and these are about half, at least smaller than half the size of a killdeer. And they have orange legs. Basically everything looks the same that you see on a killdeer. Just kind of a miniature version. So next species again, here we have the killdeer. Very common. I think overall it was like 70% of what I observed in East Tennessee. The two breast bands, they have a white wing stripe in flight, and these are very common throughout the U.S. They breed in Tennessee. They breed pretty much throughout the U.S. All right, the next group are the stilts and avocets, and there's just two species here, the black-neck stilt and the American avocet. These forage out in shallow water, and you can notice here, compared to a plover or sandpipers, notice how long their legs are. They're suited for foraging in different types of habitat, and you also notice their long bill. The American avocet here has this long upcurved bill, which really allows them to forage in different microhabitats. And that's where all these species are a little bit different. And so they can use one wetland in different ways and access different food resources. The black-neck stilt is a large shorebird. He's got these long pink legs. His legs extend past his tail in flight. And he's got a very long black bill and a black cap with a white spot above his eye. Similarly, we have the American avocet, and here we have breeding plumage and winter plumage. The only birds that I saw in Tennessee were in the winter plumage. And these guys have a white back bordered by two longitudinal black stripes and a very thin upturned bill. And these, both of these species will frequent shallow water. They're out there wading, almost like a heron species, but picking off different things, aquatic invertebrates, and also forage on minnows and other things like that. All right, but these guys have long blue and gray legs compared to the black-neck stilt, which had the pink legs. All right, the sandpipers and phalaropes fall in together, the same family, and we have 15 species of these, and these are where they get a little tricky. And one thing to mention on these, you can't just go by one characteristic. There's really, you can look at one characteristic and a lot of species will fall out because they don't match up. But you're gonna have to look at multiple characteristics to ID these accurately. And sandpipers and phalaropes in general prefer mudflats and sandy shorelines. Many of these are adapted for high-speed flight, and many of these in this group are the ones that fly these great distances. Many of the small sandpipers breed up in the Arctic tundra, and some of them fly as far south as like Tierra del Fuego down in south at the tip of South America, which is a huge migration. So we have species like the semi-palmated sandpiper and the greater yellowlegs. A lot of these species are very common in the fall. First species is the greater yellowlegs, and we'll also have the lesser yellowlegs to compare with in this next slide. Both of these species have black and white flecking on their back. Bright yellow legs, again, observed in both species. And the one thing to identify these, to segregate these from the lesser yellowlegs, is the bill length. And you see here, we have their bill length is 1.5 times the length of their head, you know, if you follow this back. And so that's one characteristic you'll look at. Also, if you have them standing by each other and you see two birds that look exactly the same and one's two times the size of the other one, you have greater and lesser yellow legs. These are two times greater in size and height than the lesser yellow legs. So here we have the lesser. And another characteristic was talking about an upturned bill, but that's tough to see. I mean, these birds are only this big out there. So, and these guys have a 1-to-1 ratio of the head and the bill length. And again, they're half the size, flecking on the back with yellow legs. The solitary sandpiper looks somewhat similar. They're kind of more of a squatty bird. They have olive-colored legs. They do have the flecking on their back, but one thing that is pretty diagnostic is that bold white eye ring. You can pick this up from quite a ways away. And with their name, they're usually solitary, hanging out by themselves. A lot of times they're more tolerant of being near vegetation than other species. So they're kind of secluded from other birds. Spotted sandpiper, and we see both breeding and winter plumages coming through Tennessee. They have a distinctive fluttery flight, and you'll when watching these birds, there's other things you can pick up on, not just characteristics, but you can watch their foraging behavior. And this species is a good one to look at that, because they often bob their tail. They sit out there. You see a bird kind of rocking back and forth. In general, it's usually a spotted sandpiper. They have yellow and orange legs. One thing to notice on the winter plumage is one thing that I pick up on. This white band that comes up and kind of wraps around the front of the wing is pretty diagnostic. I've picked up a lot of spotteds by just observing that from a distance. So you can kind of, okay, that one looks different. He's got this white point that comes up, and seems pretty distinct out there. In breeding plumage, they have these spots on their chest, which is evident in this right picture, which are real diagnostic out there. And the rest of their appearance on top is really drab. All right, now we get into the little guys. Semi-palmated sandpiper, and all these birds, the next few, these birds are like this big. And so little characteristics are what you have to pick up on these. They look very similar. The one difference with the semi-palmated is they have these black legs. And I know this is tough when we have other species with yellow legs, but when they're walking out there in the mud, it's tough to pick up. But you wait for, you know, kind of the sunlight to shift, and you'll catch a glimpse of that yellow coloration. But these guys have the black legs. In general, they're overall grayish in color. And a lot of times out there, we'll be scanning through a big flock, and you know, you can kind of tell there's mixed species, and you take a look back, and from a distance, you can pick up the gray birds from a brown bird without the scope, often better than you can through the scope. So that's another thing we use to pick them up. They have a thin, dark bill, but it's not quite as thin as a least sandpiper, which will be coming up. It's a little bit more blunt. Least sandpiper is the next guy, and you notice we're just talking about the bill color, he also has a small bill, and it's kind of down curved. And these are real narrow birds, and we actually did a food habits study on this species in East Tennessee. But they're more overall they're very similar in size to semi-palmated, but they're this brownish color that you can pick up on. They have yellow legs, and these are the smallest shorebird in North America. Pectoral sandpiper. All right, these guys look fairly similar to the least sandpiper, but these are, I wouldn't say quite two times the size, but they both have yellow legs. They both have kind of a down curved bill. The difference, these guys have a yellow or orangish colored bill, and they also have this, I don't know if you guys can see this from back there, but a distinct cutoff from this white underpart to their chest, and that's where they get their name, pectoral, just from that break in coloration. They're almost the size of a killdeer as well. Dunlin are also fairly common in Tennessee. They're kind of a later migrant, and we'll get a lot of these winter plumage birds coming through. These guys have black legs. They have a large droopy bill compared to those other sandpipers, and these are going to be a little bit smaller than killdeer size, but they are bigger than the sandpipers. In breeding plumage, one really distinctive thing you can pick up on these birds is that huge black underside, which is really diagnostic, but I think I had one bird in breeding plumage throughout my study, but it's not to say there aren't more out there. And next we have the dowitchers, and there's two species of dowitchers, long billed and short billed, and you can't go by the bill length on these guys. They're pretty tough differences to distinguish between, but In general, they have a barred tail that's black and white, and these guys have a lot of times you can pick them up by different calls, and these guys have a sharp keek call, which I actually haven't heard. I haven't seen enough of these to distinguish between them. But they have a long straight bill and dull yellow legs. And the long-billed dowitcher, one way to distinguish them, which is pretty tough, is they have a barred upper chest and a red belly. Whereas the short-billed has one or the other. They either have a barred chest or a red belly, which it can get pretty tough out there. But here we have a diagram of the bars and spots. So basically you gotta shoot one and get it in hand. No. Some people can pick these up fairly well and distinguish between the two species, but I can't say that I can. Again, they have the dull yellow legs, a long straight bill, and they're just slightly smaller than the long billed. Their call is a little bit different. They have a 2-2-2 instead of the keek. And again, I think for the undergraduate course, they just had to know it was a dowitcher. Is that correct? And I think the same is with yellow legs, right?
Yeah.
Just needed to know yellow legs.
But I was thinking you
can
go
both. I doubt we will with the dowitchers.
Maybe I'm doubting the yellow legs, but I think he almost made us use the yellow legs in that
course. Yeah. So. And they're not on, no, you can pick that up, yeah. No, not very well. There's a few exceptions with, of course, with like courtship behavior where you can distinguish between, or they know which ones incubate and things like that to pick that up. Mm-hmm. No. Wilson snipe is another very common species that we see in Tennessee. These are generally found in marshy habitats. They have a really stocky appearance with short olive-colored legs, and they have pointed wings and a very rapid zigzagging flight, just kind of going back and forth, a very long straight bill, and I think in reading some of the literature, these birds, a lot of times you'll find them up foraging near vegetation, and I think they forage a little bit, they're a little bit more dependent on seeds than other sandpiper species, where most of these birds have almost tricky. But these are very common in Tennessee. Again, we had like 15% of our total, like over 1,500 birds that we observed down at Chickamauga. And I know Drew gets quite a few out in West Tennessee. All right, woodcock. Probably the only thing you get this confused with would be the snipe, but they're normally occurring in different habitats. They're also more of a grayish overall color, and they have the long straight bill, which is similar to the snipe. And on the top of their head, they have a black crossed with pale line. Woodlands and shrubby fields a little bit later in succession than typical mudflats and emergent wetlands. All right, and this stuff will be posted on the website to help you quiz. If anybody else needs help with any of this stuff, feel free to stop by. Whatever, I have some other books and stuff that are pretty good. All right, do a little quiz. Come on, McCord. All right. Do you guys want to go through these like we did the waterfowl, or do we want to talk about them while we're going through them? To help pick up on things. It's up to you if you want to try. What's that? All right, we'll go through them here. All right, number one. Or are you talking just to blurt it out?
Yeah, I was talking about
blurt it out. Okay, yeah. Anybody know that one? Yep. Mhm. And what characteristics did you pick up on? Okay. We got this line breaking up the underparts from the breast. What else? What else do we see on this? What color is legs?
Yellow
legs. Those are things you got to pick up on all these birds. You can't just look at one thing. What's that? Yeah. Yep. And we also, I don't know if you can see this from back there, we also have, that's an orange bill. It's not black. And they're about the only ones that have that orange bill, except for spotted, I think. So, overall brownish in color. But again, that pectoral line really splits these out. All right. What do we think on this guy? What characteristics you got?
Long yellow legs.
Mm-hmm.
Bill longer than the head.
Yep. Not an equal proportion, right? He's got all that flecking on his back as well. And these guys do have kind of a distinct, you know, I use that characteristic for solitary sandpiper, that white around the eye. It's just a little bit more dominant in a solitary. But these guys do have all the flecking as well. All right, good on that one? All right. You guys know this one. What do you think? A shorebird, okay. Snipe, that's right. All right, and what'd you go off on this guy?
Olive legs. Very long, straight bill.
Yep, long, straight bill.
One thing I go by is on these, the
yep, instead of on the woodcock. Yep, exactly. So on the snipe here, the light colored lines on the head go vertically instead of across the head like on a woodcock. And it's also, you can't see his, you know, where his legs extend down to. This is a really squatty bird compared to a lot of these. His legs seem short compared to the rest of his body. All right. We got here. How many plovers we have total?
Three.
We had killdeer, semi-palmated, and black-bellied, right? How do we know this one was a plover?
Short black bill.
Short black bill, okay. And he's, of species that you require, he's a stink compared to a killdeer and semi-palmated. He's got that. A black belly, okay. Also some good patterns on his back and black legs. All right. Next bird, number 5. American woodcock, yep. And how we know this? He's got the long bill, like a snipe, and the stripes go across his head. Correct. All right. Next we have 2, number 6 and number 7. What's number 6?
Black neck stilt.
Black neck stilt, all right. And why?
The white spot above the eye.
Yep.
The thin straight bill and the solid black back.
That's right. Solid black back, white spot above the eye, the long straight bill. And both of these are very tall shorebirds. And I know on this picture you can't pick up different leg colors. But these guys are going to have the pink legs. Number 7, American avocet. And they're about the only, of the ones you require, they're the only shorebird that has that real distinct upcurved bill. And this is a winter plumage bird, almost completely white. He's got kind of the baby blue, purplish legs as well. Good? All right, number 8. Any ideas? Okay, he does have a white eye ring. You're right the first time. Yeah, and the main difference, yeah, you said he does have that white eye ring, and this bird does. But coloration on his back, he's real drab, isn't he? Doesn't have any flecking at all. He's the winter plumage bird, and he's got this white point that comes up on the front of his wing there. It's a tough one, kind of. All right, Plover or sandpiper? Number nine. He's a plover, right? Short little bill, right? Okay. What other species, what species do you have in the plovers? Yep. So what do we think this one is? Semi-palmated, and why?
Lacks red eye ring and lacks a second.
Yep, lacks a red eye ring, and he only has one band, correct? And a little bird, I mean, this guy is like this big. All right, this guy, sandpiper or plover? Mm-hmm. Color leg. Mm-hmm. What's that limited to? No. He's squatty, right? That makes him a sandpiper. The little teeny black down curved bill. Brown. What color do you think he is? Is he grayish or is he brown? Brownish, which makes him a sandpiper. No, very close. So that makes it, no. This guy is a least sandpiper. So he's gonna look, that was a good guess with the pectoral. This guy's got a black, all black bill, down curve, real small bird. He does have, you notice he does have that cutoff. And that's why you can't just go off one characteristic. So you have yellow legs, which makes him a least or a pectoral. You have this cutoff, which you think pectoral, but then you see his black, little teeny dinky bill. That makes him a least.
So.
They're about half the size, which is tough to tell from this. All right. What's that? All right. All right, so what do we think number 11 is? All right. Why is it? Big, long, black bill that droops at the tip, black legs, gray overall appearance. He's the winter plumage of the Dunlin. Correct. All right. Let me guess on that guy. What jumps out at you? That's right, solitary. He's got that real distinct eye ring, and I know some of those other birds do, but he's got this flecking on his back. These legs are actually olive colored, which is tough to tell from this picture, but and also more of a squatty bird compared to yellow legs, which are a little bit more disproportionate. Okay. Number 13, Michael McCord.
Well, here's my problem. How am I supposed to not know he's not a black bill if I can't see the bill?
There's a I'm not going to repeat that question on there. All right, what is it?
I'll take Killdeer.
Killdeer, right. Red eye ring, got rust-colored rump. Two bands, which you can't see. All right. What's that? What did you say? I did. Start cracking the whip in here. All right. How about this guy? Can y'all see that? No?
My guess would be down in the black leg.
Close. Let's see if... That help?
Yep, that didn't mean I know it.
All right, so does this guy look big?
No.
Yes? Looks huge up there, right?
Yeah, it is a big up there. My guess is because John Watts put these up here, I'd call it a leak.
No. What color legs?
Black.
Black legs. Color bill?
Black.
Small little sandpiper. What overall coloration do you see in his wings and on his back? Mm-hmm. Semi-palmated. Grayish overall color. You think it's brown? Well, got some colorblind students in here. Now, overall gray appearance, and ones will be used on the test will be real distinctive. I know these are tough. So, all right, number 15. It's a dowitcher. I'm not sure which one off the top of my head. Dowitcher species, right? Okay. It's got all that, all the barring, you know, kind of scaly appearance on his back as well. Breeding plumage. All right. But that guy. Number 16. What'd you say? Color legs. Black legs. Is he a plover or sandpiper? Okay. What sandpipers have black legs to begin with? Mm-hmm. That's it. Yep. Do y'all catch that? For the most part? Black legs, and you know it's a sandpiper. This guy's got a long bill, so he's not a plover, and you only have two species that occur in Tennessee commonly that we're covering today that have black legs, and that's semi-palmated and a Dunlin. This guy's real small, and he doesn't have, you know, the semi-palmated has got a lot more kind of scaly appearance throughout his coverts and wings. All right, 17. What? You're all over it? Yeah. So what is it? Any guesses? Dunlin. That's right. Long black droopy bill. This is a breeding plumage bird. He's got the real distinct black on his chest. Black legs. All right. Sandpiper or plover? Plover. We have three species, right? So what is this guy? Black-bellied plover. Correct. All right. What characteristics do you see on number 19? Orangish legs, yellow legs. Hint, hint. Okay. Does he have a real distinct eye ring? Not really, right? Compared to those other ones? Okay. Does he have flecking on his back? Yeah. What's that make him in general? Lesser yellow legs, right? It's a good guess, or very educated guess back there. But what'd you go off to distinguish him from a greater yellow legs? Bill length. And what is it for a lesser yellow legs? Yep, 1-to-1 ratio. Boom, boom. Good. All right. Number 20. What's that? American Avocet, right. Breeding plumage, Yep. You got the red head, upcurved bill, right? Okay. Good. The Dowager? A red belly or a barred, yeah, which looks fairly
special. There's one that
has both.
Or, and then there's one that's both.
Yeah.
That's weird.
And we won't, that won't be required to distinguish between those two. But this is a Dowager. Kind of squatty appearance, long bill, but he doesn't have, what other species have the real long bill like that, that has a squatty appearance? Like a woodcock or a snipe, right? But what's a snipe have on his back? Big long stripes going down. So you can, obviously it's not a snipe. He's got all this coloration through there. Dowager. All right. Number 22. This look like a big bird. Real small, right? Okay. Plover or sandpiper? You guys know this. Sandpiper. Right. All right. Can you see what color legs he has? Yellow. And he's real small, right? So what's that making? Right off the bat. At least sandpiper, correct. Very small little black bill. It's down curved a little bit. It's tough to tell on that. If you see a real small sandpiper out there, brown overall color, yellow legs, at least sandpiper right off the bat. Whoa. All right, 23. Any thoughts? He has pretty long yellow legs, right? Compared to the rest of his body. So that makes him a... No. Okay.
A yellow legs.
Yes. And I'm guessing these are probably graders. It's tough to tell. But, so, of all the species we're looking at, we have black-necked stilts and avocets that are real tall, real lengthy legs. You also have the yellow legs, the only other one that's even halfway close to that disproportionate. So if you see a bird with these great big yellow legs, you can almost look at him and say, okay, it's yellow leg. All right, number 24. Mm-hmm. Plover. Because little teeny beak, right? Yep. All right. Nope. So that no black belly on him. He's not a black bellied, right? Good. Oh, you got to work through them. I mean, you have your required species, so.
Does that make him semi-palmated?
Semi-palmated, exactly. He has one breast band, right? Doesn't have the red around his eye like a killdeer would either. Good. All right, 25. What do you notice on this bird that's different from what we've been looking at? Spots. Yep. Spotted sandpiper. Breeding plumage. just kind of drab up here, right? He doesn't have, he's got kind of the orangish colored legs, doesn't have any coloration. That's evident on both the winter and summer plumages. Real drab up top, and the winter plumage just would all be all white down here. But you can still see this white point that juts up right there, right? Good. All right. That's kind of the end of that. Does anybody have any questions on the ID stuff? I'm not sure at this point what will be totally required of you guys. I'll have to talk with Dr. Gray when he gets back.
Do you think he's going to work
with someone that you don't know? I don't think so.
Should you go to post the lecture or whatever?
Yes.
On the website so you have
the image? Yep. This whole PowerPoint will be put on the website as well for you guys to study over. And there's also some good resources on the internet with little shorebird ID quizzes. You have to watch some of them because some of them are going to include species that aren't part of you guys, things like that. But they can be pretty helpful. Trying to think what else. Also, I have, if it helps out, I have like 3 or 4 shorebird books up in my office up there, the wetlands lab, that anybody's welcome to borrow. So, what time is it here? What is it?
5 after 6.
5 after 6, okay. Do you want to take a little break? We don't have, we probably only have like 15 more minutes of lecture. And then keep rolling? Okay. All right, this is some stuff I put together in general about just shorebird management. And the one thing that I hope you guys picked up on, and especially in the identification stuff, is these birds look a lot different. There's different groups of birds. They call them guilds. Different places they forage, different foraging tactics, things like that. And from a manager's perspective, it's important to incorporate management activities that provide habitat for each of these different species or groups. So in order to do that, managers are, in general, try to provide different microhabitats within a wetland or within wetlands that are next to each other. Like if you're managing a moist soil impoundments, you can stagger your drawdown to provide different habitat types. If you have just pulled off some water on one, you have wide open bare mud flats where you have a lot of little sandpipers, things like that. You also have an open water zone where a lot of your larger shorebirds like avocets and things like that will congregate and forage in different little areas along the gradient. So, different things we should consider with management for shorebirds. In my previous two talks, what can you guys think of that we should consider? I just covered one, right? There's different shorebirds require different things, right? What else? What's that?
Timing
or water removal. And that's linked to, why do we worry about timing? Migration, right. These birds come through at different times, so we need to look at different migration chronologies of different species, all right? And in general, there's some guidelines that I'll show here in a minute, but it's important from a management perspective, if you have the opportunity to manage a wetland in a specific area, you want to get the most precise information on chronology. You want to, not only just for the southeast, you have a general chronology for the southeast. If you can get it down for Tennessee or East Tennessee, you know right when all these birds are coming through. And then you're getting more bang for your buck out there by providing habitat at this time compared to 2 weeks later. And that's all it can take. I talked about the average stopover duration where some of these birds are only stopping for like 10 days. You have a real short window where they need that habitat. And a lot of these, you know, different birds are coming through at different times, so it's important to follow through with your management activities to provide habitat for as long as you can through that peak migration. So that's a way we can manage to benefit the greatest number of species during peak migration. Next, where does your area lie along the migration route? What type of habitat will we be providing? Wintering habitat, migratory, or breeding? What do we provide here in Tennessee? We really got all three, right? To some degree. We provide migratory habitat in the fall and spring on these reservoirs, on some farm ponds, things like that. We had birds in November, December, January. We had a ton of birds. So we're also providing wintering habitat here, which is an important consideration. Additionally, we also have several species that breed here. We have killdeer. We have, there's black-neck stilts that breed down by Memphis, basically wherever conditions are appropriate. But again, the majority of these species that we're concerned with shorebirds, some of the endangered species, some of the ones that are shown evidence of decline are in general more of these longer distant migrants. A lot of the little sandpipers, the semi-palmated sandpiper, there's westerns, species like that. So, for the most part, we're providing migration and wintering habitat depending on when we're providing habitat here in Tennessee. If the reservoirs are drawn down early, we have migration habitat. Later on, wintering habitat. All right. And lastly, we have all these different, very diverse group, and we have to provide adequate resources to meet all their habitat and food resource requirements. All right, so the first thing, migration chronologies. You guys are required to read the Helmer's Guide. Do y'all know? I think Dr. Gray said you were. It's the Shorebird Management Manual. It's actually this right here. But it's online, there's a PDF. Have you guys looked at that at all yet? No, yeah. Anyway, all this stuff's in here, basically came out of there. So these figures and things like this, all right. So, say we're managing an area in East Tennessee and we want to know when do birds come through our area. Well, we can pick up Helmer's Migration Manual and look at this. When is peak migration coming through? And these boxes here show the peaks. When can we get the most bang for our buck? If we provide habitat at this time compared to 2 weeks later, it could be a drastic difference in the amount of use you get on your area. So you want to maximize that use. So in Tennessee, our peak migration, with these figures here, we're actually lumped in with the Midwest. And this follows pretty fairly close, but from my research and also Drew's, the peak in Tennessee is late July through early September. And both my peaks were in early September. It's hard to distinguish if that was a consequence of that's when they're all coming through when we have our highest numbers, or basically the habitat conditions were best both years at the beginning of September. So that might have something to do with it as well. All right, but other studies in Tennessee that had habitat on an annual basis also stated that these were the dates. So knowing that, all right, where do we lie along the migration route? Again, where most of the land in Tennessee would be considered a migration stopover. So, but we're also providing some wintering areas and also some habitat for breeding birds. This shows the general southward and northward migration. And a lot of these species, what's kind of interesting with them, a certain species might follow the Atlantic coast on its southward migration. I know this is true. Trying to think with like western sandpipers or something, and then they totally change on their northward migration, like they go up the Pacific coast, or some species filter down through the central U.S. and then come back on the coast. There's all sorts of things like that going on. There's a definite need for more research, more banding and stuff like that to determine kind of the annual cycle, where are these birds going on their migration. And the more we learn, the more we can provide habitat for them and realize what we're doing out on the landscape. All right, so again, it's important because a lot of these birds are only stopping for 10 days in our region. So timing is everything with migratory habitat. We have that short little window where we need to provide them habitat. All right, so different species, and I hit on a few of these earlier, prefer different, I call them microhabitats. Different ones prefer or proficiently forage in deeper water depths. Avocets, phalaropes. Phalaropes will often, they're almost swimming out there. Avocets and stilts have longer legs. They can get out in the deeper water. Whereas small sandpipers up in here, they prefer these wet areas. Here we have least sandpipers, and that's what they fall into. They can't, with legs this long, they can't forage out in those deep waters. So we have to provide them with bare mudflats, is what they prefer. Other species like the avocets and stilts are often found out in the water, so kind of an open water zone with little vegetation, things like that, as the water's coming down, adequately provides them with the habitat they need and the niche they can fill. And plovers are a little bit more tolerant of dry areas and normally don't feed out in the water near as much. You'll find these in more vegetated sites and sandy soils, things like that. So those are quite distinct habitats when you think of a completely dry area with vegetation growing to a moist mudflat to an open water zone. So we should manipulate water levels to provide these multiple habitat types. And you can do that in a number of ways, which we will look at here in a sec. There's two different, in thinking about managing for shorebirds, we have coastal habitats such as this, and you have huge aggregations of birds. We're talking Delaware Bay, along the Atlantic coast. There's a lot of stopovers along the Pacific coast. Year after year, just have huge numbers of birds. So these are definitely important to preserve and conserve. All right, these are more predictable habitats. The beach is still there every year, okay? The tide's still there. When the tide goes out, the birds get out there and forage. When it comes back up, they're restricted along the bank. But it's there year after year. It doesn't change all that much, except for with the tides. So because of that, you have these large aggregations of birds coming through and stopping at these areas. I mean, talking thousands of birds. All right, problems with coastal habitats that shorebirds face, human recreation, development, boating, people out walking their dogs. Other things, they have vehicles that they drive along the beach, four-wheelers, things like that. And a lot of these areas aren't all that big. It's not a huge, huge expanse, but there's tons of food resources there for, you know, if they're able to access all that habitat. So because of these limitations to where they can and can't go with different recreation and things like that, several studies have shown that a lot of the shorebirds are actually depleting their prey source. And one that comes to my mind is with red knots along the coast. They feed almost exclusively when they're in Delaware Bay on horseshoe crab eggs. And they come here, horseshoe crabs come up on the beach, lay their eggs, and these things are just everywhere. And they've shown that they're depleting their resources. Whereas historically, that evidently was not the case because they've been able to thrive on and use these coastlines every year after year for probably thousands of years. So the main management goals along coastal habitats, and I didn't get into a whole lot of things with like impoundments and things like that along the coast because they're kind of similar to what we try to do in freshwater habitats in the interior U.S., but to reduce disturbance is the main thing. Again, just a limited resource. They have limited food supplies. They have limited, because they have limited areas in which they can feed and roost and things like that, other just general requirements. So a lot of work has been done to preserve and protect different habitats. They've bought up quite a bit of land. There's easements. There's different groups doing quite a few things out there on the coast. They've also done some things with posting, different roosting and nesting areas that are important for these birds. You have, I think there was five or six species that, commonly breed on the Atlantic coast. And lumped in with that, we have piping plovers. And I think least terns, I'm not sure on that. But, you know, they're post aware of what's going on. And there's quite a bit of research going on with them, too. Also limiting human access. When the tides are low, these birds have huge areas where they can go out and feed. But when the tide comes back up, it shrinks up their habitat, right? Makes sense. So that's when the habitat is most limiting to them. And that's when things like human recreation and other things like that, just people out there messing around on the beach or whatever, can have the hugest impact on, disturbing these birds. So I read into a little bit on this, but when they hit high tide, they have buffer zones created where so many yards they can't access to the beach, you know, get access to the beach when it's at high tide to protect those shorebirds that are using those areas, reducing disturbance. So another thing, the last thing I covered here with coastal habitats is just to ensure the persistence of food resources. And again, horseshoe crab eggs are a significant form of food for the shorebirds coming through, and I'm not real up on the literature as far as what's happening with their populations and things like that, but you know, I know there's issues with water quality and, other things like that along the coast, so we have to take that into consideration when we realize that they're just part of the food web for other, you know, with birds coming through and things like that. So next we have interior habitats, which Tennessee falls into. So does basically the whole U.S. except for a few states with coastal access. These are less predictable and dynamic systems. They fluctuate with precipitation, both temporally and spatially. So one year you could have great habitat out there for shorebirds, and the next year you have nothing. And with more and more human-induced disturbances on the landscape and things like that, we're controlling water levels, we're doing that, we're playing Mother Nature. And by doing that, we're also influencing the temporal and spatial distribution of resources for birds coming through. So, some issues we have. The availability of water. We have impoundments. The few places that we do have impoundments that are managed for shorebirds and things, we have water availability issues. So we, with a lot of the states going through drought, they don't have enough water to allocate for shorebird management, to flood an impoundment, you know, when this water needs to go for agriculture or things like that. Additionally, with some of the drawdown schemes, we need to provide habitat for early migrants. And when you do that, early drawdowns, typically you have bigger problems with invasive plant species. So that's another issue we have. And also, since these are so isolated, you'll have large numbers of birds using small wetland areas, and you'll have tendency for disease outbreaks. All right, so the goals. I think the main one is we have waterfowl management activities in place already, a lot of these areas. This particular picture is at Cheyenne Bottoms in Kansas, western Kansas. That it's a huge spring stopover for shorebirds coming through. Well, we can incorporate management for shorebirds into existing waterfowl activities. So these drawdowns create moist soil vegetation that produces seed for waterfowl. So in drawing down these areas, you're going to provide shorebird habitat for one. But also, you're going to increase your food resources for waterfowl if you manage it correctly. If you, you have to meet their temporal needs as far as when they need water on the landscape and things like that for their migration. But these can be incorporated. Shorebird stuff can be incorporated into those things, and it needs to be more often. So, again, in places where they have large impoundments, a series of impoundments, the sequential drawdown of these impoundments is important because, again, we have all these different species we're dealing with. We don't want to just provide one habitat type out there. That's like having, okay, all we want on the ground for deer is corn out there. I mean, they need other stuff, right? So it's the same with these. We want to have different habitats for different species, and also food resources that, you know, fulfill their dietary needs. All right. So this is the handout. This is the last slide here. I want you guys to take a look at. But we have it's kind of a hypothetical drawdown scheme for 5 impoundments, which are pools A through E. And down here we have kind of the resulting shorebird use. So I wanted to go through this and just quickly, but I want you guys to explain reasons why we have, I mean, it's important to understand, okay, you're out there doing surveys and things like that. TWRA has people do these all the time. Why do we see high shorebird use in the fall following an early drawdown? You guys can tell me that. Early drawdown, which early fall would be what, August? Yep, very true. Exposing the habitat at your peak migration. So you're picking up more species, also high abundance. Again, and you see this with all these. All these early drawdowns provide the most, you know, habitat for the most birds. You increase shorebird use. So, and again, other things to keep in consideration. Down here we have late and early flooding, and this, you have to do this to create this mudflat habitat, but also these late and early floodings, this is what I'm talking about waterfowl use. You flood these, the ducks are going to be on it. So if you can time this, you know, look at your chronologies for waterfowl coming through, and time these management activities and water level manipulations to maximize, you know, the overall use of your entire area. And there's potential to do that, but Dr. Gray will get into, when he starts talking about moist soil impoundments, all the different species that they try to manage for, not only waterfowl, shorebirds, other water birds and stuff like that, but also things like amphibians and other species that use these, and what the consequences of an early versus a late drawdown. You don't want to do that with, obviously you don't want to do that with all your impoundments at once. That's the main thing, sequential drawdown. Providing greatest amount of different microhabitats to provide for the greatest number of species. So, anyway, that's all I had today. Anybody have any questions? Hope I didn't confuse anyone. You guys make sense at all? For the most part. Anything? No? Again, if I can help out with anything, with shorebird ID or understand any of this, shoot me an email or just come up and stop by. But I think that's all I got. I'm not sure what we're covering next week, but anyway.